Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Folding Pocket.
Welcome to another episode of the Rabbit Hole Detectives, a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice pronounces a winner. Hello again, rabbit holers.
Hello, Kat.
Hi, Kat.
How are we today?
Well, I'm all right. I've had some issues with dog care.
With dog care?
Yeah. I've been away so much, being on tour and everything, that both my dogs now prefer my dog sitter to me.
That's so rude.
When I came back, I walked into the house and flung my arms wide to be well by the dog. They just ignored me completely. And then this morning, the dog sitter called round and they both went into sort of paroxysms of delight.
I think they are very consciously playing the card of, we didn't miss you. It's like, you know, young children do this. They pretend they don't miss you.
I wondered about that.
And there's a revenge. I knew a woman who kept a pet otter in Zimbabwe. And she went away. And when she came back, the otter bit her really painfully in the shin. Well, it really was agony because they're quite sharp. But she said that she talked to an animal behaviourist and that was jealousy. And I think your dogs are showing otter-like jealousy.
Because I think there was something performative about their excitement at seeing the dog sitter this morning that made me think they were rubbing it in a little bit.
Yeah, they were making you feel bad.
And I felt, I'm sure every parent must feel this, not as a parent myself, I just thought, well, you know, that's the deal, I get it, but I'm the one who pays your vet bill.
Yes.
I'm the one who gets your claws clipped. I'm the one who combs you.
Freeloaders, aren't they, really?
Just take me for granted, that's okay.
But the otter was so mortified, having bitten through her very, very painfully. When she was screaming, it started crying, the otter.
So distressed.
Yes, it was an automatic thing, she thought, of biting her to punish her and then really upset at having hurt her.
Sounds like Greek myth.
Yes.
What happened to the otter? Did the otter...
No, it wasn't put down or anything. It was just she was a bit more careful around it.
Well, that's the thing. You look at your dog and you spend your time with your dog and you sort of treat them like a person and then they roll in fox shit.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Mine does that so much. He rolls in absolutely everything. So I gave in and bought her like a onesie so that I don't have to shampoo her.
Oh, what a brilliant idea.
Yeah. So she now has to wear these ridiculous looking outfits when we're out for
walks. Sooner wash that than wash the dog.
Well, I can just stick that in the machine. Well, I can't really stick her in the machine. So
I was once in Scotland and just packing the car to drive 12 hours back to England. And as we got in the car, the dog rolled in fox shit and had that acrid stench all the way home.
Yes. Nice. Awful, isn't it? I hate all that.
Yeah. On that note.
Yes, yes. Well, we're moving from that to a totally... I flagged up at the end of last week that slightly self... Well, very self-indulgent, but I wanted to pay tribute, really, to my father because the first day this podcast is broadcast is the 24th of January, 2024. And my father was born on the 24th of January, 1924. And I'm not going to bore you with his life story, but I thought I would use this excuse to give a nod to what is known as the greatest generation, because I knew nothing about my father's war years until about a decade ago. And I got a letter out of the blue at home saying, would I know, because of the name of my house being Althorpe or Althorp, would I know who a Lieutenant John Althorpe or Althorp was? And I wrote back and said, well, that'll be my father, because that was his surname as the eldest son. That's the surname he got. And the woman wrote back and said, oh, because he liberated our commune in Normandy, basically the local town. And this put me into this rather bizarre world, which I didn't know about, of learning about my father's military presence in World War II. So he was young. He was an officer who passed out in early 1944 in the Royal Scots Greys, a cavalry regiment. So therefore he was in tanks. And it turns out that he was a lieutenant in charge of four Sherman tanks, very poor quality tanks, as opposed to what the Germans had with their Tigers and Panzers in Normandy. And he landed with his men on the D-Day plus one, the 7th of June, 1944, and ended up 2 months later in those two communes, 80 miles west of Paris, of La Neuve-Lyre and La Vieille-Lyre. And he and eight men saw off the Germans that day. And it was extraordinary because, what was it? It's coming up for the 80th anniversary of all of this. So 5 years ago, I went to the 75th anniversary and they were celebrating the liberation of their commune. And there was a large memento, a sort of a statue, a monument to this liberation. And it mentioned the Scots Greys and my father's name. And I hadn't appreciated what a big deal this still is to the Normans. They turned out in their hundreds. They had found a bagpiper because my father was somehow in the Scots Greys. We're not very Scottish. And he was part of the 4th Armoured Brigade that landed on Sword Beach. And, you know, by this stage, he'd lost his best friend. He saw his best friend be killed. I understand that three of the four Shermans he commanded were destroyed by this point. And he and his eight men were acting as an intelligence unit, going ahead to see what was going on. The Germans were very ready to retreat. And when I was there in August 5 years ago, I met this wonderful old man in his 90s, I guess. And he had been one of three young men who were requisitioned by the Germans on the day my father came through these two towns to go and take some horses to a central point where the Germans were gathering anything that could move, bicycles, horses, to help with the speedy retreat. So these three young boys were sent off to take these horses across the field. On their way back, they were stopped by another German patrol and asked why they hadn't got their papers. And they explained why not. And the Germans popped two of them, a man called Marcel Boucher and another called Jacques Bernet, against a wall, and I'm afraid shot them. And this third man, old man by then, told me that he hadn't had a day since where he hadn't felt guilty for surviving and seeing his two friends die. On a more uplifting note, there was also a lovely old lady in one of the towns who came forward. She was in her 90s. And she remembered as a young girl, they had found a Canadian airman who had been shot down a few days before D-Day, and they had hidden him in a barn at huge risk to themselves, because if they had been found, they would all have been shot for looking after an Allied pilot. And so this lady said that she remembered my father coming in with his men, because she was then told that she could take the Canadian back his uniform. And she said to him, "You're free to go now." And he was a man called Sherwin, Gordon Sherwin, a Canadian from Ontario. And she still had as a memento a part of his parachute from that day. So it was amazing to be reconnected. I knew my father had been awarded a minor award of gallantry called Mentioned in Dispatches, and I didn't really know what it was about.
It was very significant.
Yeah, it was when the general in charge of an action, or a colonel in charge, had written a report of it and wanted to flag up particular people for having done particularly well. What's incredible for me now, as I'm about to be 60, is my father was 20 when all this is going on.
Just came to say, he was pretty young.
Yes. And what he saw, you know, he'd done quite well. There was an officer training corps at Eton, and he was one of the three officer cadets there. He'd passed out top of his group at officer training at, I'm not sure if it's Sandhurst or one of the others. I found a diary entry of my grandfather very proudly saying that my father was on the parade ground bellowing like a bull, and all sorts of little references. And also I knew, you know, my father had grown up in the shadow of World War II when he was at Eton. I found lots of photographs. He was always a very keen photographer. Photographs he had taken with this little box brownie of bomb damage at Eton College when the Germans had dropped a few bombs there. So this was a connection with his real war. And I read his dispatch, which he wrote on liberating these two places. When I say liberating, it sounds as though they had a huge machine gun fight or whatever, but I think they just turned up at the right time. But they were greeted with euphoria.
Which, well, that was like, though. You've been under Nazi occupation since 1940.
Yes.
Mm. And the terror of that cost in lives to the Maquis. I mean, all of a sudden, your dad turns up with a few blokes and the war's over.
And they hadn't got a lot to offer them, but my father was given a bottle of Calvados, you know, the local Splendid. Apple brandy, which he took great pride in. And when I turned up on the 75th anniversary, they gave me a batch of the same, not the same year, but the same local Calvados, which I thought was a wonderful gesture. And it was just an extraordinary thing, really, because also they said to me, I mean, I speak very rough French, but they were talking about the Irlandais, the Irish, which, of course, the Scots Greys, Irish, it's probably pretty similar if you're from Normandy. But it was lovely to be able to put a bit of flesh on the story of a very young man from that generation, what he did and how it's still remembered today.
But didn't you ask him? Did you say, what did you do in the war, Daddy?
I did ask him, and he just brushed over it. But I had a stepfather, so it's the same with this generation. So my stepfather had the horrific experience. He had an older brother who was rushed through RAF training, and 3 weeks training, and then the family lived in the southeast of England, I think in Kent, and he wanted to show them how he could fly, and he looped the loop and crashed in front of them and died. And my stepfather then, to try and avenge his brother's death, decided to enlist in the most dangerous thing he could think of, and that was midget submarines. And most of his comrades didn't make it through the war or had a particularly dangerous time of it. And he never spoke about it too. And I think it's one of those things. They did these things. And I think there was probably a survivor's guilt. My father's best friend, I only know his first name is Aidan, just popped his head up to look out the top of the tank and a sniper dealt with him. And I think you have a survivor's guilt, even if you did something that was, by my standards, very brave.
And presumably there were so many who had similar
exactly.
experiences, so you weren't, in a way, you weren't that unique,
you weren't
I suppose.
Special.
Mm.
My father, a bit younger than your father, but he also fought in tanks in the Royal Tank Regiment. Actually fought in the Korean War, but he was also in Germany after the war.
Oh, yes.
And not long before he died, and he sort of just dropped it into conversation, though I wonder if he was trying to perhaps tell me something, I don't know. He'd been at Belsen.
Oh.
And this was after the liberation of Belsen, but not long after the liberation of Belsen. And he was stationed in the old SS officers' barracks, and only half a mile over distant it was from the camp. There was a rose garden and a swimming pool and a concert hall. And a bar. And, you know, people would come home from
it's
the camps and have a bath and a drink and a dance.
Yes, with Which, their families there.
And that had something that had rather haunted my father all his life, I think.
Yes.
And he chose to talk about it not long before he died.
Oh, as a sort of sensitive human being, as I'm sure your father was, it must have been impossible to square that out as a logical scenario.
Lots of my vicaring was at the deathbeds of people of their age who had fought
yes.
in the war. And it was very shaming at first to realise that the kind of old boys in their blazers with their Jack Russells and their Daily Expresses down the Bowls Club, who I'm ashamed to say I perhaps didn't take that seriously.
Yes.
Actually, once I got to know them, you realise that they had served on midget submarines or minesweepers or North Atlantic
yes.
convoys or in Lancasters.
Yes.
Extraordinary. And they were in their 20s.
Yes, yeah. It is. The youth of it is really extraordinary. I remember growing up in Norfolk, the local priest, a man called Pat Ashton, he was one of the first people into Belsen, and he apparently went grey overnight, just the shock of what he saw. A young man who'd never had any concept that humans could behave like that to each other.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's chemically possible, but that's what they said about him. Anyway, I've got a favourite fact, which is totally
yes.
away from this rather sad subject. And I was thinking of my father's regiment, the Royal Scots Greys, who no longer exist. They're now part of the Royal Scots Dragoons Guards. But I remember my first conscious awareness of that regiment was from Dino De Laurentiis's film Waterloo from 1970, which starred Rod Steiger as Napoleon and Christopher Plummer as Wellington. And one of the most beautiful moments in this film was a slow motion charge of the Scots Greys, where everything goes beautifully for them to start with, and they capture a couple of eagle standards for the French, but then everything goes very wrong when they're then attacked by lancers and they only have swords. But what I was so interested by was, and this really is a rabbit hole within a rabbit hole, it is the movie. It's beautifully shot, and you can't believe the scale of it. It's shot in Ukraine, actually. They use 15,000 extras in full uniform. That is the largest number of extras that ever been used in a movie, I believe, in one sort of scenario, as it were. And it didn't do very well at the box office. It became a bit of a cult classic afterwards. And it had two effects, this movie. The first was it gave a stillbirth to a biopic that Stanley Kubrick was going to do on Napoleon. But more relevant to recent cinema history, it inspired Peter Jackson. He said that was the film where he could see very large scenes of dramatic action taking place. And that coloured his vision as a filmmaker later on.
You'd never get 15,000 extras. Now, we would have to with CGI, but also the economics of that would be impossible.
Yeah. Did you see that movie, Richard?
Yeah, I loved it.
Okay, I got a really obscure... I had no idea this case. Who played Louis the 18th in a cameo?
Was it Christopher Biggins? That's my answer to ever any of those sorts of questions. I don't remember.
Orson Welles.
Oh, no.
Another multi-talent.
Well, yes. I always say the American Christopher Biggins.
Excellent. Love that. Well, that's a lovely way to remember your father's anniversary.
Yes, I know. It's rather bizarre.
Lieutenant Orson.
Yes. And this year is his 100th, my 60th, my son's 30th birthday, and another son's 21st, and a daughter's 18th. Anyway, but I wanted to just remember not so much him, but that generation.
Very nice. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So on to me this time.
He's bound to win now, okay, isn't he?
I know. It's sickening, isn't it? That's why he did it. That's why he chose it, wasn't it?
I know,
we
might as well go home now.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's not about the winning, Richard.
My uncle Bob flew a Hurricane. All right.
That's why you like Hurricanes. They're your favourite plane.
They are my favourite plane, actually.
Fine. Right. On to my topic, which is Agatha Christie. So one of my
You're going to win.
How can she not win? Come on. Seriously, absolute favourite of mine. And one of the first series of books I started reading was Agatha. I was completely obsessed with these. And I used to read my mother's old Agatha Christie novels that I found in the loft. I just went up in the loft one day and found all these huge collections.
In what language?
Swedish they were in.
Oh, hold on. So,
yeah.
So Swedish.
Yeah.
Not Norwegian.
No.
Your mum's Swedish.
Yes. Okay. So they were in Swedish. But
how do you say Miss Marple in Swedish?
I don't know what she's...
My Spanish friend knows that. Señorita Marples.
Fru Marple.
Fru Marple.
Fru Marple.
That suits her, actually.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm probably something like that. I'll have to double check that.
Yeah, I've just had a look and it... I mean, don't ask me to pronounce it, but it does seem like that.
Yeah, Fru. It would be Fru. Fru means is Mrs. basically.
Fru Marple.
Fru Marple, yeah. There we go. Now, obviously, as we all know, one of the most successful, or the probably most successful author really ever, more than 2 billion copies sold. It's ridiculous. Her books have been translated to 103 languages, 66 novels, 14 short story collections, and more than 20 stage plays. But I think her history and her background is really, really interesting. I know she's come up before. You mentioned, talked about her disappearance.
Yes.
When you talked about famous disappearances, and I'll get back to that later on. So she was born in 1890, Agatha Mary Clarissa Miller, in Ashfield in Torquay. She had an American father, and she was actually homeschooled by her father, which was quite unusual. She had much older siblings, so she was essentially an only child just at home. And they were quite well off, but got into some financial difficulties, so they had to rent out their house in the summer and live in France. And actually, this seems to possibly be what triggered her immense interest in travelling, which we see in her books and her stories as well. Her father died when she was 11, and she actually later said that that's when her childhood ended. But she came very close to her mother. But later on, this also led to her mother being quite obsessed with her getting married and finding a suitable husband. She did get engaged, but she wasn't that keen on getting married to her fiancé. And she met instead in 1912. She went to a ball and met the young Archibald Christie, who was a pilot.
He was a rotter, wasn't he?
So they fell in love quite quickly, and she dismissed her former fiancé, and they got married at the just beginning of World War One. And as Archibald, or Archie, was sent off, she ended up volunteering with the Red Cross Hospital. She volunteered in surgeries, and she was partially in charge of taking the amputated limbs away from surgery.
Well, they're not going to walk themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Literally.
They could be used for skates.
Yes. Yes. Maybe that's what
going back to the last episode.
But she also, later on then, moved on to qualify to work in the apothecaries.
And that's apparently where she learned about poisons, which obviously comes in quite often in her books. In fact, 41 out of her 66 novels involve poisons. Mm. So that's where she learned all of this. But yeah, as she said, her marriage wasn't actually a very happy one. He wasn't a very nice man. And eventually she found out that he was having an affair and he wanted to leave her, divorce her for another woman. They had a daughter together called Rosalind, but the year she disappeared was also the same year that her mother died. So it was a really traumatic year. Husband wanted to divorce her. And again, I think people should go back and listen to your description of that in a former episode. Mm. Essentially, what happens is that one day she leaves two letters at home and drives off in her car. Her car is found crashed in a quarry. And for 11 days, she is gone. She's missing. Huge, big media interest in all of this. Of course, you know, crime writer being possibly the victim of a crime. Mm. She turns up in Harrogate in Yorkshire 11 days later, apparently not remembering at all what happened to her. But she's already written several of her novels by this point. And she was with a publisher. She had a contract for 5 books, but it was a really bad deal. It was very exploitative. There was very little money in it. So at the end of that, she managed to get out of it and go with William Collins. In fact, going HarperCollins, and it happens to be both Charles and my publishers as well.
We sold slightly less than 2 million as well, haven't we?
2 billion.
2 billion,
2 billion,
sorry.
Yes. Yeah, getting there.
Early days.
Yes. she wrote for a long time, so there's still time for us to do that.
A late spurt.
Yeah. Now, that move was with the what's often considered her masterpiece, which is the book called The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which was her big, huge, big break. Actually been voted one of the most influential crime novels ever written. Now, later on, then after this disappearance, so she stayed with Archibald for a little bit, but then eventually they did divorce. And she won custody of her daughter, Rosalind, and fled overseas. Again, she was travelling very, very frequently. She started writing a book a year, and that's her productivity is obviously part of her success, the fact that she can manage to do so much. And then in 1928, she travelled to Baghdad. And this is a big change in her life because it sparked her interest in archaeology. This is also where she met her future husband, the archaeologist Max Mallowan. Now, he was actually 14 years younger than her at this point, so there was a huge, big age gap. But they very much hit it off very, very quickly and went back to get married. Apparently, they both lied about their dates of birth and their ages when they got married because they felt that this difference was too much. It seemed to be a very happy marriage, and it really marks a turning point for her. She also said, apparently she's quoted to say about Max, that an archaeologist is the best husband a woman can have because the older he gets, the more interested he is in her.
That's very clever.
But she continues to be hugely successful and her career just really blossoms. She buys lots of houses. She ends up with 8 properties at some point. And Max has his archaeological projects that she takes part in. She pretty much funds them as well through her work. And she keeps on writing and they have this quite nomadic lifestyle. They go abroad overseas and spend the winters on digs and places where they travel to. And this becomes a huge part of her work as well. So you have everything from Murder in Mesopotamia, which of course is very heavily inspired by her digs, everything that's set in Egypt. Murder on the Orient Express is part of her travels and going to Mesopotamia. When World War II hits, she goes back to volunteering in hospitals again. And at this point, she's written her Miss Marple books and Poirot as well. Poirot, incidentally, was apparently inspired by her work during the First World War, where they had a lot of European refugees in Torquay. And so this idea of this Belgian refugee was inspired very much by the people who came into Torquay when she was volunteering. But she actually wrote 2 books during the Second World War because of all the uncertainty. So she wrote the last books on Miss Marple and Poirot during the Second World War to be locked away into storage in case something happened to her. And they weren't actually published, one posthumously and one quite close.
I haven't read them. Do they die in them or how do they end?
Oh, I actually don't know. So I don't think they die, but they are the end last stories. Perhaps the disembodied voice can look into this for us.
I don't think they do.
No.
I think it's last cases.
Yeah, the last cases as opposed to their death.
Yeah, so actually, Curtain was printed in 1975, which was just before she died, and Poirot does die in that. Though in Sleeping Murder, which is the final novel involving Miss Marple, which was printed in 1976 after Agatha Christie has died, she actually survives.
She didn't like one of them, did she? She didn't like Poirot, I think.
Did she not?
Well, she liked Marple and didn't like Poirot.
One of them she didn't like. Do you like your vicar protagonist?
Yeah.
You
do, don't you? I do. Yeah, it's got a bit of mileage in it, I think.
And would you say, are your books inspired by Murder at the Vicarage? Just one I've heard.
Well, my life is inspired by Murder at the Vicarage. well, you can, I think, I know, Agatha Christie is probably the queen of crime. And there are other women crime writers of that period who I think I like more. Marjorie Allingham would be
and
one.
And Dorothy L. Sayers, fantastic.
But Agatha Christie, I think, is extraordinary.
I think one of the reasons why I think she was so successful was, I mean, obviously they are really clever stories because they are so difficult to guess, very well plotted, but they're very much about humans and human relationships. She was very interested in psychology and in this, you know, what these sort of really dark sides to people. So you have actually quite normal people who do really dark things. I don't have a favourite. No, I do like Murder in Mesopotamia and I like the archaeological ones. And I'm sure that must have inspired me as well as a child reading all of this.
I like The Mirror Cracked. That's a terrific one.
Yeah.
And
have you seen The Mousetrap?
I have actually, but
I haven't.
I haven't.
You know that we Rabbit Hole Detectives are going to be doing our live show on Saturday, February the 10th at the Royal and Durngate, Northampton, Harry Nell. Well, we are sandwiched between, in that venue, a Luther Vandross tribute band and The Mousetrap, which is on its 70th anniversary tour.
That's a good sort of claim to fame.
I've seen it. I can't remember anything about it at all. When I was on tour, Kat, in the 80s, in a very turbulent world, I used to read Agatha Christie novels all the time. I found they gave me a sort of
stability.
Sense of... continuity.
There's something quite reassuring about them, isn't there?
And they're a very good brand.
Yeah.
They deliver, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Mm. And she was actually, I mean, if you look into what she was doing and what her publishers were doing as well, so she was managing to churn out another book every single year. And she'd write it in the winter and then in the summer she'd spend time with the family, but she would also do the edits and all of that. And then they would essentially come out in the autumn before Christmas every year. So there was a Christie at Christmas was a thing.
Christmas.
And so it became a really, really popular annual, essentially, business plan, really, which of course
very
is
clever
is fantastic.
If you can stick to it. You do about one a year, don't you, Richard?
One a year, yeah.
And you find it very easy to get that done.
Well, I do it.
Do you know The Mousetrap, actually, how that came about and why that was written? Queen Mary was asked by the BBC what she wanted for her 80th birthday, and she said she wanted an Agatha Christie play. And so she wrote Three Blind Mice, which then became the play, The Mousetrap, first performed in 1952. And it's the longest running West End play. And it's run nonstop, apart from a brief break during COVID.
Yeah.
It's just run nonstop. I think part of her success was just the fact that she was so prolific and so productive. And she obviously hit on a formula and she had all these series. But still, I mean, you get the odd one that's completely different characters.
Yeah, there's the hippie one, isn't there?
Yeah, there's some really interesting ones. And you read them and you think,
have you actually read
different?
Do you think you've read most of them, Richard?
I think I read all of them, more than once, actually. It's funny, I went to see The Mirror Cracked, the stage version of that, because my friend Joe McFadden was in it. Came to Eastbourne, to the Devonshire Park Theatre. And I was watching it and I thought, there's a really clever thing in this, I can't remember. Then all of a sudden the woman sitting next to me went, German measles! She just said it out loud, because she remembered.
No.
And I thought, spoiler, the whole bloody audience, you've just said the whole thing. German measles! She went.
I remember.
Have you written it now for people?
Yes, probably.
Yeah.
But I remember going to the lovely cinema in Northampton with my children when they were younger. And we didn't know. We were looking at the options. And one of my daughters said to the bloke behind the kiosk, said, so what's Seabiscuit about? And he went, small horse, big heart, wins the big race. And I thought we didn't really need to see that one at that point.
Do you want to know my favourite fact?
Yes,
on
please.
This one? I thought this was quite funny. So apparently, so you've got various side characters, obviously, and it's said that one of the ones that comes up quite a lot in the Poirot stories is a woman called Ariadne Oliver, one of the side characters. And it's said that that might be her sort of putting herself into it because she is a writer as well, a crime writer who helps her out sometimes. And she writes a series about a Scandinavian detective, actually, apparently. And it's a sort of slightly comical character as well. And apparently that's meant to be herself.
Max Mallowan, her husband, I don't know anything about his career as an archaeologist, I just know he was one. But was he distinguished?
Yeah, extremely distinguished, actually, and very a very good archaeologist, as far as I know. He worked largely in Mesopotamia and in the Near East, one of that sort of generation when archaeology was really starting as a very scientific discipline. And I think the fact that she was part of it, so she started learning about it as well, so she was doing photography, apparently, drawing, and actually actively taking part in the archaeology itself. So they were a good couple.
I knew a thing about her. She loved the cinema. She used to go to the cinema in Paignton in South Devon so often that she had her own seat there.
Oh, I love that.
Brilliant. She always had the pictures on her own. Loved going to the pictures.
Yeah. Wonderful. And then finally, we're going to move on to you, Richard, and your topic this week, which is the theft of relics.
The theft of relics. Indeed.
That sounds like an Agatha Christie.
It does sound like an Agatha Christie.
Yes. Well, it's going to be a Canon Clement mystery, I'm pretty sure. You've both touched on relics, of course, in what you've been speaking about. You as an archaeologist have been excavating these objects, which are of a greater significance than their inherent value. You, Charles, spoke about that portion of parachute silk preserved by the lady in the commune your father and his comrades liberated in 1944. Mm. Well, relics, of course, these objects that have this connection to something beyond themselves. Now, if you're a religious person, if you grew up in the Christian tradition, if you lived in Christendom at its most vibrant, I suppose, in the Middle Ages, relics were incredibly important because they gave you this physical connection to something of heaven. Relics, the physical remains of a saint, the body, perhaps a garment, perhaps something associated with them. There are different classes of relics, primary, secondary, tertiary. We'll get onto that, I think. But what they gave you was that direct physical connection to the life beyond. A saint is someone who lives like they're already in heaven. And if you can get a bit of that, well, then maybe that improves your chances of making heaven too. The cult of relics started very, very early, and that's partly to do with martyrdom. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, said Tertullian very early on in the church's history. And of course, as Christians rose in power and prominence, the Roman authorities in the empire saw that as a threat to their power, so they persecuted them. And as a result, martyrdom was a very common fate for Christians in that first period of expansion. And that meant bodies. And where there were bodies, there was veneration. And where there was veneration, all of a sudden, there was the need for relics. So very early on, the bodies of martyred Christians, they would be buried somewhere, and then there would be a church built there, and a cult would build up around that particular saint who might have an association with a place or a particular profession or an element in the Bible story, whatever it might be. And that connects, it weaves itself into the lives of the faithful. And then people started, as the theology of this developed a little bit, it was believed that the bodies of the saints, their mortal remains, contained something of heaven in them too, and that every atom of that body was filled with the promise that inhered in the whole of the body, you see what I mean? So you could have a toenail, you could have a hair, you could have a flake of scurf of a saint, and yet everything that ensured that saint's place in heaven would be fully present in that thing. What did that mean? Well, it meant with the church's expansion, you could take a bit of this, a knuckle perhaps, a knee, a hair indeed. Some of them were quite extraordinary. A feather from the Archangel Gabriel's wing was quite a popular relic for a while. I'm not sure how, you know.
I love Kat laughing. She was talking about Thor last episode.
What? What's the problem?
Blood, breast milk from the Virgin Mary, an angel's breath, something like that, or the breath of the Christ child, all could be taken. But what you did get, of course, was that every church, as Christianity expanded and settled, grew more powerful, wanted a bit of a saint, really. You needed a relic in your church to give it that kind of spiritual authenticity. And so a market grew up around relics. Now, this was complicated because you could not sell You couldn't put an economic value on something of heaven. So you couldn't sell a relic. But if there's a market for relics, what are you going to do about it? They developed the reliquary. And that was the case, if you like. The reliquaries became very ornate and very gorgeous and very jeweled. And so what you sold, and it still is the case now, you can't buy a relic, even on eBay, although you'll find them on eBay. You buy the capsule, you buy the reliquary it comes in. So that was the thing. But as this market developed, then, of course, unscrupulous dealers realised that there were other ways of obtaining these relics. There's a notorious one called Deus Dona. I think in the 9th century, he was a very big trader in relics and was rather notorious, in fact. And quite a lot of relics made their way around Christendom that way. But it got a bit more interestingly complicated because by the time you get to about the 11th, 12th century, this market for relics had become so intense that people started to need to find a way to obtain them dishonestly, but make it honest. And this is where the furta sacra, or furtum sacrum, the holy crime, the holy theft. So there's a notorious case, one of my favourite, Hugh of Lincoln, who's one of my favourite, great Hugh of Lincoln. There's a little Hugh of Lincoln, we won't go there, that's bad. But the great Hugh of Lincoln was the Bishop of Lincoln. Went to visit the monks of Fécamp in France sometime in the 12th century, maybe the 11th century. They had a hand of Mary Magdalene, and they invited the saint, who was very famous, he wasn't a saint yet then, to venerate it, and he did, and he kissed it. But while he was kissing it, he actually bit off a chunk of the finger to take home, to the consternation of the monks. But the defence would be, if you did that, it's rather a shocking thing to do, doesn't it, to dishonour your host so much that you would bite the finger off their relic to take home, that the sort of doctrine of the furta sacra said that if the saint didn't want you to take the relic, then it would turn to ashes in your mouth or become so heavy it couldn't be transported, or you'd be struck by lightning. And there were cases, notorious cases, reported of people trying to steal a relic and it all going very, very wrong for them. Not the case with Hugh. He took this back to Lincoln and it ended up in Lincoln Cathedral. So the furta sacra taught that it couldn't be a crime if it happened, if you see what I mean. So basically, if you got away with it, then you could say that this was, in fact, the will of saint and consistent with the will of God. And you'd be right. Monks went to extraordinary lengths about this, you know. There's the Abbey of St. Foy at Conques. St. Foy was a 4th century martyr, a girl who was martyred on a gridiron, I think. She was tortured with a gridiron and then beheaded, I think. Typical of the time. She's 12, I think. And anyway, her sort of relics went around, and they were significant relics of hers were held at the monastery at Agen. Now, there were some Spanish monks displaced by the Moorish conquest of Spain who came into France and were looking for somewhere to kind of settle, and they did at Conques, and they needed some relics. And they thought, well, we'll have a St. Foy, thank you very much. But, of course, no one's giving her away. So they put a monk into that community and kept him there undercover for 10 years. By the time that 10 years had gone by, he had been sort of promoted to custodian of the relics of St. Foy, which, as you can imagine, didn't last very long. And they were whisked off to the new abbey at Conques and remain there to this day. Yes. And there was a sort of complicated row between them over the legitimacy of this. But as the monks of Conques would say, well, listen, nothing happened, right? So obviously St. Foy was keen for us to come here. And of course, it was very important on the pilgrim routes. If you were going to Santiago de Compostela, you would stop off there. Hundreds, thousands of pilgrims coming through. So there was a roaring trade, if you like, on the pilgrim routes. People come. So if you were on a pilgrim route, or even better, you could become a centre of pilgrimage if you had a great saint like St. Thomas Becket in Canterbury. Near to us, Charles, in Peterborough, the cathedral city of our Shire County, St. Oswald, there was an arm of St. Oswald. Well, the legend goes that it was carried there by a raven. Anyway, the monks of Peterborough ended up with the arm of St. Oswald, and it was kept in a reliquary in a chapel there. But it was so highly prized that they built a little kind of room. There was room for one monk in there, but you couldn't lie down or kneel in it. You had to stand, and it was so you would keep a permanent watch on this relic of St. Oswald, lest it got nicked. It did, of course, get nicked. The Reformation came along. A great many of the relics that were once considered so important were kind of burned on bonfires or...
Do you think, Richard, when the reformers, the Protestants, when they burnt these objects, did they burn them as ridiculous, or did they burn them thinking they were the real thing but they still had to go?
I think what they thought was nonsense, and I thought the whole cult of the relics was seen as a sort of superstitious con trick forced on the gullible by a Roman church that sought to arrogate to itself powers that weren't properly its. But I think they also wanted to make a spectacle. I think they also wanted to say there's a new game in town now and all these things that were once cherished.
Yeah.
They also, there's famous cases of an abbey in Kent where they had a famous rood, and the Christ on the rood would sort of come to life, and they found that it was operated by pulleys and levers. Turns out, of course, that it was a sort of advertising gimmick saying, come to our abbey. No one was making supernatural claims for it, but it suited the reformers to say that it was, to demonstrate the kind of wickedness of the Roman Church in forcing its superstitious practice on people. And that was burnt in London, taken to London and burnt in a big bonfire. The Bishop of London preached an uncompromising sermon about that. I should say, of course, it's not just Christianity that has a trade in stolen relics. There was a theft not that long ago in Cambodia of relics of Buddha from stupas in that country, and they popped up. Notorious case, I think only last year, I think there were 55 Buddhist images, idols, as they're called, which were stolen from a temple and turned up in a private collection, having been mediated through a gallery of slightly doubtful provenance. So that's a thing.
And in Ukraine as well. So Putin's men went into one of the churches to steal bones of one of the quite recent army generals or something like that, a military person, and taking them back to Moscow just for the same reason.
And the defence would be, of course, that you're not looting. What you're doing is preserving.
Yeah.
And there's an echo of this, interestingly, in our current very live debate about the Parthenon marbles in the British Museum. And one of the defences for what some would say maintaining looted relics in the British Museum is that it actually preserves them. It makes them more available to scholarship and for the enjoyment and edification of others that they're in the British Museum. Now, you might think that argument's nonsense. I think it is nonsense. But you can see a sort of recap of trying to justify the taking of these objects, not just because you want them, but because somehow you're doing them a service by doing so.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Kent, I think, earlier, and that did you hear about the bones, the relics that were found and identified as one of the early female saints of Ainsworth or Ainsworth?
Oh, no, Saint Ainsworth. I haven't heard about this.
And presumably they were hidden away during the Reformation.
Yeah.
This was a female saint from the 7th century. And more recently, in the last couple of hundred years, a secret room was found in the wall when some building work was taking place in this church, found to contain a collection of bones. And they were recently tested and found to date exactly to the date that the saint was meant to be the patron saint of this church.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think it's an assumption, perhaps, of a secular age that the whole thing was a load of nonsense.
And
people said that if you put together all the fragments of the true cross, you would find a forest. Well, actually, somebody did do an inventory of all the fragments of the true cross and found that it was much less, in fact, than the volume of what the cross would have been. So I think there's a sort of anti-Catholic prejudice that has sort of sneaked in underneath our awareness. And, of course, if somebody was acclaimed as a saint or someone remarkable in their lifetime, then it's not unthinkable that their remains would have been very carefully preserved. Mm. I mean, there are some complications. For example, there are at least three heads of John the Baptist. And there was a famous case in the Middle Ages where two towns both claimed to have the head of John the Baptist, and it caused so much aggro the Pope intervened, and the Pope rather judiciously ruled that one of them had the head of John the Baptist as an old man and the other had the head of John the Baptist as a child. So that very was
good.
Okay.
That's a good, I like that. Do you have a favourite fact at all?
Well, I do have a favourite fact. As I say, relics, there are primary, tertiary and secondary if you do the Roman Catholic classification. Primary relic is a bit of the saint. I've got a primary relic of St Thomas the Apostle. You'll be interested to hear. Doubting Thomas. A secondary relic is something that they used, something they wore, a blanket or something. And a tertiary relic is just something that's touched either a primary or a secondary relic. One of the most precious ones, if that's the word, was in Scotland, and it's St Finan's Bell on St Finan's Isle, which is in Loch Shiel up in Moidart. And you might know it from the Harry Potter films, you know, the Black Lake in the Harry Potter films. Well, it's filmed there.
Okay.
Uninhabited island. It's the burial ground of Clan MacDonald, actually. Uninhabited, apart from dead MacDonalds. And there's a church there which is dedicated to St Finan. And there, his bell, 1,000 years old, that was secured there with a lavatory chain. And it was felt that that was insufficient to provide security. So they forged a new chain for that bell. And then in 2019, I think it was, somewhere in June or July, somebody went over and, using professional equipment, sawed through the chain and stole the bell. It's not the only bell to have gone missing. So it looks like somebody somewhere is stealing these ancient bells associated actually with Irish missionary saints to order. So who that is, and I don't know. And why they're doing it, I don't know.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
I've thrown everything in this, but you've got your dad in with his hero war record.
I know you're undermining my...
You've got the queen of crime in. Well, all I had was a smelly old saint.
Going to be a tough one this time, isn't it?
I think we're really tough.
So, disembodied voice, please give us your verdicts. Who's winner this week?
Well, I was going to go for the smelly old saint, but Richard, maybe you make me change my mind. No, I wouldn't do that. Yeah, theft of relics.
Well done.
Hurrah.
Well done. Very good. Yeah. Excellent. So, let's go home and revise for our live show, which is coming up very soon.
Very soon.
Our live show is on the 10th of February in Northampton. Just search online for Rabbit Hole Detectives.
At the Royal Theatre.
That's right. So, before we go, actually, we also have to tell our listeners what our topics are going to be next week. Now, I am going to be sticking with Scandinavia. You'd be surprised to hear.
Yes.
And I'm going to talk about...
Centre of the world.
Yes. The law of Jönte.
The law of what?
Yeah, well, you'll find out next week. Something very Scandinavian. Richard, you'll be talking about luggage.
Yes.
And Charles, Morris dancing.
But of course.
Oh, are you going to be demonstrating to us as
I have Morris danced.
You haven't.
I have.
You hate dancing.
I like a bit of ritual.
So you haven't ice skated, but you have Morris danced.
That's right. I'm in that very small subset on the Venn diagram of dance.
Well, I'm going to anticipate this conversation. I'm fascinated by the thought of you Morris dancing. That's a very counterintuitive item on your CV.
Thank you very much. Not professionally, but I have done it a few times for fun near Northampton. Yeah. Moulton Mummers and Merry Men, I think they were called.
Excellent. Are there pictures? Are there photos?
I hope not.
Okay. Really, if anybody out there has a photo, please send it to us.
Can you do Norwegian traditional dancing, Kat? There's a circle dance, isn't there?
On skates.
There are various things. I don't know how, I know, but
yes,
there are.
You do.
No, I really don't.
Come on. You've done roller derby.
Yeah.
Ice
not.
Skate. You can do the circle dance.
No. I'm not a dancer at all.
I'm not a dancer. It didn't stop me going straightly.
That's true.
Come on, we can all do it.
I'll have to look it up. We'll see if I can find that YouTube video. So that's it for this week. Thank you to everyone out there for listening. Please subscribe and leave us a review, because it really helps people find us when they're searching for a new podcast to listen to. And we do love reading your reviews. You can also send us an email, especially if you'd like to suggest a topic for us to look into in the future. That's rabbitholedetectives@gmail.com. So, in the words from Lewis Carroll's Alice, what is the use of a book without pictures or conversations?
Very wise.
We're going to run out of Alice in Wonderland.
We are so close to running out.
You make them up, no one will know.
Or maybe in the next season we could pick a new book.
Yes, maybe suggestions. Send us suggestions, people out there, listeners. What we can do for our new quotes. Maybe rabbit related.
Watership Down.
Watership Down. Bright eyes burning like fire. Bright eyes under my tire.
There we go. All right. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.